Well, we're continuing our study of Nehemiah this evening. We're looking at chapters 3 and 4 specifically. Since it was a week and a half ago that we began this, I thought I'd take just a minute to kind of get us back up to speed to where we were after Nehemiah 1 and 2. And specifically, I want to redraw my poor map from last time just to really get back in our head how tight of a spot we might say Nehemiah was in when he came back. I can still see the map from last time. Here's our basic Palestine. At least that's what it's supposed to look like. And Nehemiah's come back, and basically, and he's in this area of Judah trying to rebuild. And the first thing that he finds out, he leaves with the king's blessing and the king's permission and letters from the king and soldiers from the king and provisions from the king, and everything's great to go back to Jerusalem to rebuild the walls of the city. And when he gets back, what he finds out is there are enemies everywhere that he looks. There's this guy named Sanballat, at least that's how I'm going to say his name, who's up here in Samaria. And there's another guy, Tobiah, who's over here in Ammon. And you think that's bad enough through the first chapter and a half, and then suddenly this other guy, Geshem, shows up, and he's an Arab, and what you find out if you do any more research on him from stuff outside the Bible is not only is he from Arabia, which is down here behind the podium for you, but he's also in a powerful family that's taken control of Moab and Edom. And their reign even extended all the way down in the direction of Egypt, which is further down, but probably down that-a-way. And so this is the situation Nehemiah faces when he gets back to Palestine. He has the royal decree to do the work that he's supposed to do, but when he gets there, he's surrounded by enemies. And chapter 2 ends with the decision to build. They get back, they're going to do what they're supposed to do. In verse 18, he tells them that the hand of God has been upon me for good, and also the words of the king had spoken to me, and the people said, "Let us rise up and build." So they strengthen their hands for the good of the work. And so the people decide they're going to build, and what happens immediately after that is they're jeered at by Sanballat and Tobiah and Geshem, who all say, "What is this thing you're doing? Are you rebelling against the king? Who do you think you are that you're going to come back here and build?" Sorry, I left my clicker up here. It'll work out by the time the evening's done. And so that kind of is really not only the first stage of what they go through. They decide they're going to build, and then they're mocked by the people there. That also is basically the pattern for what we're going to see tonight in chapters 3 and 4 that continue that basic theme, where here chapter 3 is an extension of their decision to build. They're going to do it. It tells us how they did it. It gives us some very specific details. And then chapter 4, we find the continued opposition, the jeering that they still face, and then even worse than that as the chapter continues. And that's what's going to happen from this point on. Chapter 3 is essentially a list of who built and what they built and where they built it. There's a lot of things we don't know specifically about who a lot of these people are or where a lot of the locations are specifically that are discussed. But there are a few, I think, important things we can get out of chapter 3, so I want to not just completely skip it this evening. The first thing I want to point out are a few what we might call linguistic connections to what's going on around chapter 3. Specifically, first of all, the work that they do, there's a connection back to chapter 2. In verse 18, the verse that we just read, it says, "Let us rise up and build." And then if you take out the verses where they find the opposition in verses 19 and 20, chapter 3 and verse 1 picks right back up on that theme. Eliashib the high priest rose up and built. And so they say, "Let's go get up and do this." And immediately after that, they got up and they did it. And so there's just this connection back. This is the continuing of the story without a break, without a pause, without a hesitation. They just jump right into what they said they were going to do. And then the other, what we might call linguistic connection, is the framework that is created around chapters 3 and 4 by a word that we wouldn't pick up in English because there's no good way to translate it, but the word repaired, which is used 34 times in chapter 3, And the word held, where it says that they held their weapons, it says it six or seven times. No, it says it three times in the end of chapter 4. They're forms of the same word. And so basically it's creating a framework around this entire story that tells us that the play on this words tells us, the framework tells us that this is a narrative, this is a story about repair and defense. That's what these two chapters are about. That's all interesting and everything, but I suppose that if you couldn't just read chapters 3 and 4 and tell that it was about repair and defense, narrative framework probably wouldn't be your cup of tea anyway. But it is an interesting thing that that's one of the ways that point is being made around chapters 3 and 4. We also learn something about the workers. There's quite a variety of people here in chapter 3, and we're not going to take the time to read chapter 3. I hope you've done so, or you will on your own at a later point. First of all, they are identified in a variety of ways. They're not all identified the same way, which tells us there's a little bit of difference about them to begin with. Some are identified by their family, some are identified by their profession, and some are identified by their place of residence. They're not all like, you know, line them up, they're exactly the same cookie cutter sort of person. And you see that even more clearly when you see the class of people that there are. There are priests working. The high priest himself is working. There are rulers. In verse 12, we read about the ruler of a half district in Jerusalem, and there are a few others along the way. Verse 16, we find another ruler. There are what we might call lay people, just your average Joe sort of guy. There are people who weren't from the city of Jerusalem who were working on the wall of Jerusalem. Which probably is a good way Nehemiah was reaching out to the people around them who would be on their side to kind of cement the alliance, you might say, with them, to really shore up the relationship, get them to not just buy in, but to be a part of the rebuilding so that they have something invested in it themselves. And all of them are working side by side. It's really interesting. I should have marked the verse down, but I noticed when I was reading it. There's one spot where it's just talking about some guy who's working, and right next to him is the high priest, and he's working, and there's no distinction, there's no difference, they're just all working arm in arm, so to speak, on the same project. And it's really probably the Old Testament's best picture of the ideal Israelite brotherhood that God has always wanted. And you see even more clearly specified into the New Testament, where it talks about there's in Christ there's neither Jew nor Greek, male nor female, bond nor free. And we could extend that into all kinds of other applications in our culture, but that ultimately everyone who is in Christ is the same. And I think this is a small picture of the way that was intended to work. On top of that, this chapter tells us about the organization of the workers. As often as possible, the people worked on a section of the wall that was right next to his house, which wasn't only convenient for them, but it also gave them good motivation to do good work on this portion of the wall, because it's going to be what's protecting you most immediately. And it also, you know, I want to work in this good place over here, or I want to work over there. There are no arguments about who's going to work where, who's going to get the easy job or the hard job, or the sunny spot or the shady spot. You're working by your house. That kind of solves that issue. Guy. I don't know the answer to that question off the top of my head.
Because later in chapter 13, he calls for a separation.
Yeah. And the intermarriage problem was one back in Ezra, too, that they were marrying with the foreign people. And again, the problem wasn't that the race. The problem was they were intermarrying with idolaters. And I have seen some people who suggest that part of what the wall is doing is not just building to protect the city, but it's creating that kind of symbolic barrier between God's people and the nations again. So there certainly may have been some of that in what's going on. As to the specifics of whether or not they were working on this, I just don't know. Tom, you know anything about that? Travis?
Not on that in particular, but I was going to say, it's just a side comment. It's interesting to notice that in all this list of people, you never see a professional wall builder or any form of, you have perfumers and you have all these seemingly random occupations, but never construction worker or never carpenter. And it kind of goes to show that, and that yet these people were so enthusiastic to do this. And it shows, it's a good example of a good attitude where, you know, we're not necessarily put where we are normally comfortable.
Yeah.
But we do what we can.
And that, I mean, I'm not sure how far you want to take that by extension, but certainly I think there's a point that you need to do the work for the Lord that you need to do, whether or not it's your top five things you'd like to do. It's obvious that God has blessed different people with different abilities to do different things, but I don't think that is, in its very essence, an excuse for you to not do other things that need to be done. And yeah, I think there's maybe an analogy to that here.
This was not easy work. Some of those blocks were 200-300 pounds apiece.
Yeah, and they weren't exactly stacked up nicely for them to, you know, go pick up. This is remnants from Babylon destroying the wall. All right, and then the circuit that they take, it begins and ends at the Sheep Gate, which is on the northwest side of the city by most people's estimate. But verse 1 talks about rebuilding the Sheep Gate, and verse 32, it ends back at the Sheep Gate, and they kind of, what they do is essentially go around the city clockwise, working on the different things is the way the description goes. But beyond that, it's really hard to know all the specific locations. Some of them we could pick out. I don't know that it's worth our time to draw a map of Jerusalem and point out all the individual locations. I don't think it'll really help us understand the text that much better. But that's essentially what this description does, is start at the top of the city, work its way around to the top, and that's the description here. All right, that's my brief perusal of chapter 3 without getting into all the names and occupations and other sorts of things. Any other comments on this before we get to chapter 4, which is where we'll spend the bulk of our time? Guy? Yeah, and that's really displayed in chapter 2, where what he says to the people is, God is with me and the king is with me. And notice the order. God is with me and the king is with me. And when he faces that opposition, they jeer at him, what are you doing rebelling against the king? And then his reply isn't, I said the king is with me and I have these letters to prove it. His reply is, God is with me. And that's really where his emphasis is. Tom, were you going to say something?
Well, I was mentioning the one guy who had his daughters out there.
Yeah.
Yeah,
that's verse 12. The ruler of the half district of Jerusalem repaired he and his daughters. And that's an interesting point that I think we see throughout Nehemiah, is that children are not excluded from doing the work of the Lord. And here the work of the Lord is specifically rebuilding the wall of the city, which is obviously what he wanted them to do. But then later in Ezra's public reading of the law, it wasn't... well, we'll get to that when we get to that. Never mind. Harold?
You pointed out, too, in an earlier class, that this... people, we think of the Jews as being a very closed brotherhood, but they weren't that way at all. Anybody that wanted to get in step with them could be a part of what they were doing. And it's so significant when you look at all of these people just jumping in there and doing the job.
Yeah. Anything else?
Well, this issue that was raised about, you know, sending for help, you know, reminds you back in Ezra chapter 8 where Ezra faced a similar situation. His response to that was he was ashamed to ask the king for help because they had claimed that this was the hand of God that was favorable to them. So it may be that Nehemiah would have felt the same way.
And one of the things the text doesn't clarify is exactly what happened to the escort that he had, because there were people who went with Nehemiah to help him out and make sure they got there safe. What happened to those guys after that, whether they just got them there and turned around and went back or whether they were hanging around, it's hard to say. But one of the things that is very interesting is that for the most part, Nehemiah's enemies, and we'll see this as chapter 4 develops, for the most part, Nehemiah's enemies resort to threats and taunts and accusations and we're going to kill you, but they never really do. The one time that it really looks like they're going to begin to do something beyond talking, they find Nehemiah and his group finds out about it, and they back off immediately. And I can't help but wonder if part of what's going on is they know good and well the king is behind this work, and if they actually go after Nehemiah, the cupbearer to the king, if you remember, they're going to be getting themselves into some serious trouble. And that may explain part of why they talk a much bigger game than they do anything with.
This happens a lot in government where you have political appointees and they may have an agenda, but the career political servants may not agree with it, so they slow roll it.
Yeah. All right, well, we need to get into chapter 4. I was hoping to have time to read some of chapter 4, but I don't think that we will. So we're just going to talk about it. Verses 1 through 6 begins with them basically, we might say, attacking the morale of the people. It's the oldest trick in the book. Sticks and stones may break my bones, but words can never hurt me. But the words really do hurt. That's how Sanballat and his cronies begin. And it's the kind of thing that's worth trying, because even though it's not going to accomplish anything too terribly much, it does have the ability to hurt. It can unmotivate somebody, demotivate someone. And it's certainly worth trying for them, because it doesn't really require any facts. It doesn't require any sound arguments. You don't have to be intelligent or be able to put together a real case about anything. You just have to talk. And that's basically what they do. He runs through a string of rhetorical questions that are filled with sarcasm and bitterness. What are these feeble Jews doing? What a withering, pitiful group of people. They couldn't do anything worthwhile. What do they think they're going to do? Will they sacrifice, they say? And it's kind of a sarcastic, what are they going to do, pray the wall up? That's their only hope to get this thing built. They can't accomplish anything. Maybe they think if they offer enough sacrifices, the wall will just bring itself up. He asked, will they finish up in a day? The point being, you know, this isn't a day job. You people have no idea what you're taking on. This is going to be so much harder than you think. You think you're going to do this wall, but just wait 3 days in, you're going to be tired of it and you're going to quit. Will they revive the stones out of the heaps of rubbish and burned ones at that, which is basically just exaggeration. The city gates have been burned, but the stones hadn't actually been burnt as stones can be. They've just been, you know, knocked over. So what he's trying to do is demotivate them with his words, make them think that they're not going to accomplish anything so that they'll give up on their own. And his motivation, one of the really interesting things about this is we get a little bit of a peek into his character by what's said about him at this point, because there's all this bravado that he has as he's mocking them, and there's all this taunting and sarcasm, but really he's kind of transparent. It's obvious that he's afraid of their success. I mean, what is the point of trying to stop them at all, of going through all this work of trying to make them think they're not going to accomplish anything and they better stop right now, if he doesn't deep down believe they're going to do what they're setting out to do, and I don't want them to do that? I mean, if he really thought they couldn't possibly accomplish this feat of rebuilding the wall, go sit in his living room and watch him not do it. But deep down, he knows that this is going to happen, which is why he has to stop them. And on top of that, not only is he afraid that it's going to happen, but he realizes he is completely powerless to stop it. The emperor is on their side. There is nothing that he can do to physically coerce them from building this wall, which is why he has to resort to taunts such as this. Like I said, if it were really so impossible, why would he be so angry? If he really could stop them, if he really would stop them, why is he just taunting them about it? And then after this, Nehemiah, of course not being able to see into Sanballat's character, he issues a prayer, which is something of an imprecatory prayer. That's the kind of thing that calls on God to curse one's enemies. Verse 4 of chapter 4, "Hear, O our God, for we are despised. Turn back their taunt on their own heads and give them up to be plundered in a land where they are captives. Do not cover their guilt and let not their sin be blotted out from your sight, for they have provoked you to anger in the presence of the builders." And so Nehemiah calls on God to curse them, to not forgive them, to bring their taunts back on their own head. And this does have parallels in some of the Psalms that use this kind of language as well. And I want to take just a very brief digression. Brief. Everybody with me? Brief. Okay. So, what do we do with these imprecatory prayers and psalms and things that we find. What is the solution? Because obviously what we think when we see this is absolutely terrible. Jesus says, turn the other cheek. Jesus says, pray for your enemies. And he doesn't say, pray for their taunts to be turned back on their head and for God not to forgive them. That's obviously not what Jesus is talking about. So what's going on in this Old Testament language where these people of God are calling on God to curse people? What do we make of this? Well, let me run you through some of the things that I've come across. First of all, some of the things that I think are just unworkable solutions, things that people have suggested that I personally don't see any merit in. You may, but that'll be a discussion for another day. Some people say what's going on here is, listen, there's just a difference between the Old Testament and the New Testament. Old Testament's one thing, the New Testament's another thing. The Old Testament, God's a God of wrath and anger and vengeance. The New Testament, God's a God of love and hugs and teddy bears. And that's the difference, and that's the solution to it. And I just don't think that's the case, because God is God. Although God's laws have changed, God Himself has not changed. And even more pointed than that is that in the Old Testament there is grace and compassion and love, and in the New Testament there are curses and imprecations. And so you can't just say one's the old, one's the new, and that solves the problem, because it doesn't solve the problem. Well, some people have suggested instead that what's going on is this is just uninspired hatefulness. That these people, this part of the Bible is not inspired, and that's the solution to it. People are being people, and that's the end of the matter. My problem with that is that it's found its way into the Bible without any editorializing of God saying, okay, this is their uninspired hatefulness, but don't be that way. It's kind of hard for me to get around that this uninspired hatefulness has made it into the inspired Bible. And the fact that it doesn't have any divine condemnation really kind of calls the entire thing into question at that point. Some people have said, well, this is just quotations of what the enemy said. It's not really the psalmist saying it. He's quoting what they said to him, which is a nice little way to solve the problem. And there are a couple of places where the verbs and nouns are plural instead of singular, or singular instead of plural, I should say. And it might solve the problem in one or two cases, but it really doesn't help much of anything. Some people say, instead of saying they were uninspired, some people say, well, they were inspired. They were inspired so they could do it. God was writing through them so they could do it. We're not inspired, so we can't. Well, that's a neat little way to solve the problem of the imprecatory psalms and the imprecatory prayers and Nehemiah and others, but it doesn't solve the problem of why it's in the Bible as an example for us. And obviously the psalms themselves, as what is often called the prayer book of the Old Testament, the hymn book of the Old Testament, a book that the people of God used in their own study and devotion and worship, why is it in there for people to use if it's just okay for them to say but not okay for anyone else to say? And so this, I don't think, solves the problem either. Some people say that they weren't curses, they were future pronouncements. It's the prophets of God prophesying about what's going to happen to them instead of calling down curses. It's a future tense. And again, that's one of those things that in a few of the cases you could kind of squeeze that in and make it fit, but really it's not a solution to all of the imprecations and the implications of them. Well, some of the better solutions that I've seen along the way, at least what I think are better solutions, some people say what you find is messianic fulfillment to these imprecatory psalms. After all, the New Testament writers quote several of the psalms specifically. They don't quote Nehemiah and some of the other imprecatory prayers, but they do quote several of these imprecatory psalms. And so it finds fulfillment in Jesus, and so therefore we're not supposed to pray like this. It was all taken care of in the time of Christ and what He will do at His second coming even. But the New Testament quotations of these is very selective. It's not complete. And there's no reason to look at any of those psalms or prophecies that are quoted as exclusively messianic. They certainly have a broader view beyond that. So I don't think this solves the problem, but it at least makes a little bit more sense than some of the others. Others have suggested that it's stylistic, hyperbolic language. It's the nature of poetry. They're exaggerating to make a point. They don't really want people's heads to be bashed in. It's exaggeration. That's what's going on. And that can kind of fit in some cases. Certainly it fits with the poetic language that almost all of these imprecations are found in. And so that helps. But again, I'm not sure that it solves every problem. And so what I lean toward myself is to really look at these instances in a bigger context, look at them more fully. And what you find when you see this is almost every time what the psalmist, what the prophets, what the people of God are calling on God to do is judge these people for what they have done. They almost always ask God to do something that would glorify His name and bring down the enemies who are not glorifying God's name. They never say, God, give me the ability to smite these people myself. They say, God, you take care of this. And ultimately, I think what's going on in these psalms is a real life picture of what we're told in the New Testament, which is vengeance belongs to God. I will repay, says the Lord. And what the psalmists are doing is they're saying, God, you will repay. Go to it. These people are evil. These people are wicked. They're not bringing glory to your name. They're standing in the way of what you want to be done. And so God, take care of it. And so it seems to me that almost in every one of these cases is they're rejecting personal vengeance for divine vengeance, which ultimately is what the New Testament teaches exactly the same way. Now, how far then can we go in praying for God to take divine vengeance on our enemies? Maybe that's another discussion for another day as well. At least we don't want to get too deep into that right now. But this seems to be what's going on in almost every one of these imprecatory prayers is they are asking God to take vengeance as God said He would instead of taking it themselves. Adam?
Do you think along those lines that there's a difference between in the sense of somebody who, personal, that I've got a problem with them and an enemy who is a clear enemy of God?
Yeah, I'm trying to think. Are there, Tom, you know any instances where it's more personal than it is an enemy of God?
The Sermon on the Mount where Jesus says, you've heard, love your neighbor, hate your enemy.
Yeah.
You know, Jesus is saying, well, no, that's not the way you love your enemies. You know, Jesus praying for forgiveness, they know not what they do, and kind of an ignorance versus people who are outright rejecting God. Is that part of it?
That, off the top of my head, I would say that seems to be part of it. Every example I can think of, the most egregious imprecatory psalm is where the psalmist calls on the babies of the Babylonians to be destroyed, and even that is because they're the wicked Babylonians who have defeated God's people and mocked God's people and told them to worship for sport and all of those kinds of things. I can't think of any personal vendetta kind of imprecatory psalms or prayers.
Well, some of them do seem to be individuals who have been afflicted by evil people, but they're still pretty obviously enemies of God. Of course, if it's David or somebody, he's not just a person. He's king or whatever. So.
All right. Well, I'd love to talk about this a lot more, but we just don't have time. So I'll wet your palate and then leave you wanting. Chapter 4 continues on with Nehemiah planning a defense. At this point, they decide, verse 7, Sanballat and Tobiah and the Arabs and the Ammonites and the Ashdodites heard that the repairing of the wall of Jerusalem was going forward. And so they plotted to come together and fight against Jerusalem and cause confusion in it. Verse 11, they say that they're going to come in among them and kill them and stop the work. So this is as serious as it really gets. They're actually planning to do something beyond just taunts. Now, the one thing I'll point out back to my map for one second is that all of a sudden the Ashdodites are in the midst of all of this as well. The Ashdodites have moved into the land that was once the Philistine territory, which is over here. So now he's really boxed in. He doesn't even have the ocean to his west to keep him safe anymore. There are enemies on every single side of Nehemiah and the work that he is trying to do. And so then it says in verse 9, we prayed and we set up a guard. And we see in this, what we see over and over and over in Nehemiah, the partnership of heaven and earth, of trust and good management, we might say. And notice the order, as we noted before, it's God first and then man. We saw it in chapter 2. First of all, we saw it in verse 4, where the king says, "What do you want?" And he prays, and then he asks the king. And then later in chapter 2, we see it when he's come back and he says, "God is with me," and the king has spoken this as well. And then chapter 4, verses 4 through 6, "Hear, O God, our prayer," as he begins to pray. And then verse 6, "Then we built the wall." And then we'll see it also in verse 14, where he says, "Remember the Lord and fight for your brothers." Every time that there's something that they need to do, the first place he focuses the attention is God and what God is doing before he gets around to what we need to be doing on our side of this as well. But notice he doesn't just say God is great and he'll fight for us and that's the end of the matter. But also he doesn't say we need to work on our sword fighting skills because we're going to have a battle to fight. There is the partnership of God and man, and God's grace and man's obedience, man's trust, but man's working at the same time. But always the focus is first on God and what God is doing. Verses 10 and 11, we find one of those bad coincidences of timing. The people of Judah are disheartened in their work. They're beginning to doubt their ability to complete the task. There's too much rubble by ourselves. We will not be able to rebuild the walls. And the enemy said at the same time, whether they hear the Judeans saying this, or it's just they happen to be saying it at the same time, what they say is, we're going to sneak in and kill them and stop the work. And so it's just a bad timing altogether that they're losing heart. At the same time, the enemies are getting more and more serious about stopping the work and going in and fighting amongst them. And that's exactly when Nehemiah steps in and rallies the troops, gives what might be his little motivational speech. "Do not be afraid of them. Remember the Lord who is great and awesome, and fight for your brothers, your sons, your daughters, your wives, and your homes." And this is the point then where what happens next is the work resumes because Sanballat and his buddies find out that the Judeans heard about what they were going to do. And as soon as he knows they heard about it, the sneak attack has been foiled, and so they're not going to attack anymore at all. Which, again, I think goes to show that he was kind of looking for a reason to not attack in the first place. I mean, if he was really serious about fighting them, a bunch of nobodies, you know, a little bit of this, a little bit of that, perfume sellers with a sword, I mean, if he really wants to fight them, he can. But he decides not to as soon as there's a good excuse not to. And this is really the fourth, what we might say, counter move that Nehemiah has made in this chapter. This chapter has really been a series of one thing happens and Nehemiah reacts, and another thing happens and Nehemiah reacts, and another thing happens and Nehemiah reacts. And it begins when the enemies taunt him with these rhetorical questions and all of this taunting. And so Nehemiah reacts to that by praying and concentrating and focusing on the work that needs to be done. And then in verses 7 through 9, there are plots that are made against them, and that's met by prayer and setting up guards to watch over them. There are the stronger threats made in verses 10 through 14, and that's met by a general call to arms. Okay, we really need to get ready to fight in case that happens, and the charge to remember the Lord and be ready to fight if they need to. And now, all of a sudden, there's peace. You might call peace, a little bit of lull in the activity, and that's then accepted by Nehemiah as a chance to get right back to work rather than resting on their laurels or whatever else the case may be. Certainly not to disarm. They don't believe they're safe, but each time the situation changes, Nehemiah immediately reacts to it and reacts in the right kind of way as well. And you just see a great picture of his leadership developing, that he knows exactly what to do in every situation to make sure it all works out the way that it needs to work out. And chapter 4 is just a great picture of his leadership. Well, the chapter ends then with the continued protection of them, what Nehemiah plans to do to make sure they're going to be safe as they go forward. Again, just because there's a little bit of a lull from their enemies doesn't mean that they're completely safe. at this point. And so he divides his team, we might say, into two groups. There are some who are builders and some who are soldiers. Some who are going to watch and let the others build, and they're just going to take care of everyone. Then we find out that some of the people who were carrying the rubble, they're the ones moving the stones, they had a free hand, so they carried a sword in it to be ready to get to fighting if they absolutely had to. Then there were the ones who were the builders on the wall, and the ones who were building, well, they didn't have a free hand, so they strapped a sword on, and they were ready to fight if they had to. And then there was a trumpeter, and he stayed with Nehemiah in case the alarm needed to be sounded, I think is the implication there, so that the leader there can say, okay, let's call them all together. The trumpet would sound, and everyone rallies to a point to fight if they had to. And then overnight, we had some shift work guards that were established to protect them and their work overnight. And the ones who weren't awake at night guarding, they slept ready to fight. They slept with their clothes on and their swords on, and they were ready to go at any point they needed to. The last thing I'm going to say about this chapter is kind of a different way of looking at it. One of the outlines I came across when I was studying it is more of a, I don't know, more of a preacher-friendly outline, we might say, lessons to learn from the chapter that I thought was helpful if this is the kind of thing you're looking for in a study of a chapter. Verses 1 through 3 teach us that conflict is inevitable. You're setting out to do something, you're going to run into problems at some point along the way. Verses 4 through 9 tells us that prayer is crucial. You want to get out of your problem, you want to solve the problem of conflict, you turn to God. Discouragement is understandable, verses 10 through 12. You're going to run into obstacles, you're going to face problems, you're just going to get fatigued by the whole thing, and it's going to wear on you at some point. Verses 13 through 20, unity is essential. If you're working with a group, especially if you're working with God's people on something, you can't be working in different directions and hope to accomplish it. Verses 21 through 23, finally, then sacrifice is inescapable. The solution to the problems you face is not every man for themselves. The solution is everyone has to give a little bit to make sure it all works out. Any last comments? All right, thank you for your attention.